Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your entrepreneurial peers on the path to self-leadership mastery and life success. Redefine how you lead as you redesign your business. I call this dual innovation leadership. Take charge of who you next become. Feel more deeply to think, act, lead, and mentor more clearly and effectively. Discover something new from our meaningful conversation today. Welcome to We Mentor Mondays. I'm Nancy. In episode 384, we will discuss what we need to know about forensic psychiatry with Dr. Mark Levy, part three. Before we get to our discussion with Dr. Mark Levy, today's sponsor is Midwest Bakery, and I'm excited to tell you about their delicious all-natural halal bread. I'm so jazzed about their bread products that I'm helping them grow their bakery. They follow the Muslim definition of halal, H-A-L-A-L, ensuring their bread and hoagie rolls use only permissible ingredients. Check out MidwestBakeryHalal.com to find a store near you. Remember, you don't need to be Muslim to enjoy their food. If they're not in a grocer near you, talk to the store director and request it. After all, grocers want to stock the products that you love to eat. In this conversation, we will continue learning about forensic psychiatry and also psychology and how it applies to everyone. To refresh your memory, Dr. Mark Levy is a licensed clinical and forensic psychiatrist with over four decades of experience. He is a graduate of Columbia University in the San Francisco Psychoanalytic Institute. Dr. Levy has been certified by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology and the National Board of Physicians and Surgeons. He's an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, and an adjunct associate professor of psychiatry at Stanford in the School of Medicine. Dr. Levy and his team of 22 board-certified psychiatrists and 10 forensic neuropsychologists practice forensic psychiatry at Forensic Psychiatric Associates LP or FPAMed.com. Dr. Levy has been retained as a forensic psychiatric expert in more than 500 civil lawsuits and related matters. He has published numerous articles and presented countless talks on forensic psychiatric topics, such as mental illness in the workplace and shrink in the courtroom. Whew. Always a mouthful when I'm introducing people, but welcome to We Mentor Mondays.
Pleasure to be back with you, Nancy.
Oh, good. Well, we began our first podcast conversation with you giving us a working definition of forensic psychiatry. When we think of forensics, you mentioned we think of dead bodies and autopsies, but forensics means the law and forensic psychiatry as the interface of law and psychiatry. This means you understand legal terminology and medical terms. You can prescribe medication, monitor its effects on the brain and body, and track and test human behavior and how one thinks. What would you like to add to this definition?
Well, there is a similarity between the forensic pathologist or coroner who one sees on TV in crime series and the forensic psychiatrist, even though the psychiatrist is not generally concerned with dissecting corpses and trying to determine cause of death or information about the likely perpetrator. And that is that just like the forensic pathologist who is trying to make an evidence-based accurate diagnosis, in this case, cause of death, the forensic psychiatrist similarly is a psychopathologist. That is, he or she is trying to understand what made this person behave the way they did, particularly around the time either of the crime or of the behavioral problem that gave rise to a civil complaint. And to do that, just like the coroner or the forensic pathologist, the forensic psychiatrist needs to look at objective data. And that's part of that is where the forensic psychologist or forensic neuropsychologist comes in, because they produce test data that's accurate, just like a blood test or an x-ray is accurate, way into the 90s percentile. No tests in medicine are 100% accurate, but they're very, very accurate. And so they're relied upon as objective evidence, at least important data, not the only data that's looked upon. So the similarity is that both professions are trying to make evidence-based determinations about aspects of the person who's the subject of the litigation or the criminal prosecution.
Interesting. Can someone be both a treating psychiatrist and an independent forensic psychiatric expert for the same person, like someone who's a patient and a plaintiff or criminal defendant in a legal matter? And if not, why not?
Absolutely not. That is, you can't wear two hats for the same person. You cannot be both an independent forensic psychiatric expert and the treater of the person, as the lawyers like to call clinicians, treating clinicians, treaters. However, most forensic psychiatrists, myself included, pursue both roles, just not with the same person. So I have patients, and then I have people who I examine and develop forensic psychiatric opinions about, but I don't do it for the same person. Shall I explain the difference in the role between a treating clinician and...
Yeah, I think that would be great. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. In a nutshell, there are huge role distinctions between a treating psychiatrist and an independent forensic psychiatric expert or psychological expert, but I'll speak about psychiatry since that's my profession. These distinctions between these two roles center upon the mission, the method, and the ethical duty of the consultant. So in medicine, throughout medicine, and not just psychiatry, guided by the Hippocratic Oath, our mission is to alleviate suffering, because as a treating psychiatrist, people come to me because they're hurting in some emotional way. They rarely come out of intellectual curiosity. And if they do, they're not really going to be an effective patient unless I can help them see that their intellectual approach is really a defense against things that are bothering them more deeply. But that's very rare. People aren't going to spend the money to go see a psychiatrist for an intellectual excursion, unless, except in particular circumstances where they're in training. And that's a whole other discussion. So the mission as a treating doctor is to help them alleviate suffering. What I rely upon as a treating doctor is their subjective self-report. Mm-hmm. And by that I mean, if they tell me that adverse experiences happened in their childhood, let's say that their father was abusive to them, I accept that as their subjective reality. I don't go about trying to independently confirm whether or not that's true. The exceptions are somebody who is acutely psychotic and maybe having delusions. The TV is talking to them and sending them coded messages, or license plates are sending them messages, or there is a Martian who's trying to kill them. They're so far outside of consensual reality that I obviously don't accept that subjective report from them as accurate.
Oh,
but
I
for
see.
Most patients in psychiatric treatment, the clinician accepts their description of what's going on in their life and what their history is. And the mission of a treating clinician, again, from the Hippocratic Oath, which in the Hippocratic Oath, it's primum non nocere, first do no harm in Latin, is to do what the doctor feels is in their patient's best interest. For example, when people go to their doctor and say, you know, I need a note to get off work because I've got this back pain, the doctors want to be helpful, and they usually write a work excuse note. And that may or may not be accurate. The doctor doesn't usually, the treating doctor, bother to find out, well, what actually are the work requirements? And is what I've diagnosed going on in your back really an obstacle to that? Or do you need accommodations of certain kinds or whatever? That's done in a very specific kind of forensic exam, actually, called a fitness for duty exam. But that's not what a treating doctor usually does, who's busy, cares about their patient, and wants to be helpful. What that means is that a treating doctor is an advocate for what they believe is in their patient's best interest. Attorneys are advocates for either side, for the defense in a civil matter, for the defendant in a criminal matter, or for the prosecutor in a criminal matter, the state is their, who they're advocating for, and in a civil matter, the plaintiff. In contrast, the mission of the forensic psychiatrist is to try and determine what is objectively true. And that means, what really happened?
Yeah.
Is the circumstances as described in a civil matter in the plaintiff's complaint an accurate description, or is it a highly subjective description, cherry-picking facts that support it and avoiding facts that might disconfirm what's being alleged? I'd like to use the example of the ballistics expert because, in general, although this gets argued in court also, a ballistics expert says definitively, this shell was fired by this firearm, or it wasn't. And it's much more difficult in behavioral medicine to reach those kinds of definitive conclusions. But the gold bullion standard is to try and, as best you can, say what is objectively true based on the evidence, not based on my authority. I've done this for X decades, and so I'm, you know, a big mucky muck, and I say it's true, therefore it's true. That doesn't cut mustard. The method of the treating, of the independent expert, is to look at all available data, medical records for years, any behavioral medicine records, psychiatric, psychotherapy, whatever, all of the legal records, sworn deposition testimony by critical witnesses, or what are called sworn declarations. And then depending on the case, it could involve looking at employment records, police records, military records, with a minor, academic records are very important. So all of this data, plus getting a skilled forensic psychologist or neuropsychologist to administer objective and robust psychological tests, multiple tests, not one test, and ideally what are called multiple modality tests. There are different modalities of testing. And that data is accurate, as I mentioned, at a very high level of proof in the 90s plus percentile, which is analogous to all medical testing, whether it's blood tests, imaging studies, et cetera. Why that's relevant is that when an expert is providing sworn testimony or writing testimony, but particularly under oath in court or in a deposition, the level of proof, this is a legal standard for testimony, is preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not. That's really 50% and a feather if you try to fine tune it. And that's very, there's different levels of proof in legal proceedings, like we've all heard in a criminal matter, you have to be found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. But that's not the level of the proof to which experts testify. It's preponderance of the evidence, this lowest level of proof. When I have, for example, reviewed the medical records, the deposition transcripts, and I have test data that all collide, that all support each other, reinforce each other, I have a very high level of confidence in the accuracy, the objective accuracy of my opinions, much higher actually than preponderance of the evidence, but that's all I have to legally state it as being. However, my confidence is great, so I probably convey it in a much more compelling way.
Sure. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
So those are the main differences between the treating doctor and their mission, method, and ethical duty. I didn't tell you the ethical duties. Yeah.
Yeah.
I forgot that.
Yeah. There we
go. The ethical duty of the treating doctor, as I said, is to do what's in the best interest of their patient. The ethical duty of the independent expert is to the trier of fact. That's usually a jury. In some cases, which are called bench trials, where there's only a judge, frequently in will contests and probate matters, there's just a judge. Sometimes in family law court, there's just a judge. But whoever is the person who decides what is factually true, the jury or the judge, if there's no jury, that's to whom the forensic psychiatric expert owes a duty. Not to the attorney who's retaining the expert. And this becomes quite different when an expert doesn't know what their role is as an expert, and they're really also the treater. Because, as I said, the treater sees their duty as to helping their patient. Let's say the plaintiff in a civil matter, that collides with the attorney's duty to advocate for their client. And the plaintiff's attorney frequently tries to use the treating doctor as a quote independent expert, but they're not independent at all. And they usually haven't looked at all the data, and they have this primary duty to advocate for their patient. An independent forensic psychiatric expert does not advocate for the plaintiff if they're retained by the plaintiff's counsel, or for the defense, whoever's the defendant, a company, a person, if they're retained by the other side. They advocate for their opinions based on the evidence to the trier of fact. And their only duty to the attorney retains them is a fiduciary duty to perform, to provide whatever they've contracted to provide for X amount of compensation.
Oh, boy, there's a lot to this, and the ethical duties and who your audience is, really, like, who are you, you know, supporting? I think that's advocating for. Yeah.
If I could just add to that, because it's that's what's in part I find so interesting about forensic psychiatry, because it's much more ethically nuanced. I've unpacked a lot in what I just said over the last few months, but it's much more ethically nuanced than the treatment relationship between a treating doctor and their patient. They're basic sort of signposts. You don't sleep with patients. You don't go into business with patients. There's boundaries that you don't cross. But there's only a limited number of those, and they're pretty blatant. You know, anyone can know when someone is violating boundaries. But it's much subtler in the relationships that a forensic expert has, because you want the attorney who's retaining you, who's paying you, to like you. You want more business from them. Do you adjust your opinions and your testimony to please them?
See,
that's where it gets very muddy. And even as you unpack that, even more subtly, to what extent can you shape your opinions to conform to the theory of the case that the retaining counsel has? And to what extent is it unethical to do that? For example, if I was an expert for a plaintiff's counsel, and it was a neighbor dispute, you know, and they were fighting over property lines, and the plaintiff was alleging that they were emotionally very distressed by what their next door neighbor had done to them. I might learn in the course of examining the plaintiff that they were raped as a young person. But there's no reason for me to offer that information in testimony because it's not relevant to the issue. And if I were asked in deposition, I'd have to answer truthfully. But I don't have to offer that, introduce that information, because it's what the court would consider prejudicial. It's beside the point, and it may color the trier of fact's view of the person. But if this was an employment, sexual harassment, sexual abuse case, and the person had a history of sexual assault, it might be very relevant. That same information might be very relevant. So there's this trough in which the opinion of the expert lies. There are boundaries, and you don't go over the guardrails, but you can, within the trough, be at one end or the other and still be ethical in the opinions that you're providing, if you follow that.
Yes. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, what kinds of questions are forensic psychiatrists asked to address by the attorneys who retain you and your team to help them educate and persuade the trier of fact, both in civil and criminal litigation?
Sure. In criminal matters, in a sense, it's simpler. Not that criminal cases are simple, but the questions are quite simple, and they are usually questions of criminal capacity, competence. The most common, comes up all the time in criminal courts, is this person competent to stand trial? And a significant minority, but a significant minority of people are not competent to stand trial at the time that they're being charged. There's something called a preliminary hearing where the charges are read to the criminal defendant. And if they're deemed not competent because they are there's a case called Dusky, a Supreme Court case, which defines the criteria for competence to stand trial. But if they're, and the essence of it, I won't go into the details, is you need to understand what a legal proceeding is. You need to understand what the charges are. You need to be able to assist your attorney in defending you. If you believe that your attorney is sent by the devil, you obviously are not competent to stand trial. So that, I mean, made an extreme example, but there are many much subtler examples. When that happens, the person is sent to, usually to a forensic psychiatric unit of a mental hospital, a state mental hospital, to try and restore competence. And what that may mean, being put on antipsychotic medication so that they're no longer delusional. That would be a simple example of restoring competence. Then they come back, and if they are deemed by an expert to be competent, they're tried. But there are people who are never competent, and they ultimately are not acquitted, but they're sentenced, in a sense, to an indefinite sentence of being in a forensic psychiatric hospital until they're deemed not a danger, because criminal matters are usually matters involving danger. In civil matters, although we have also in civil matters capacity issues, such as, did the person have the capacity to make a new will or trust? Or were they so demented or frail and just disabled that they couldn't meet the standards for having that capacity? But, and there's also capacity to testify. Sometimes people, when they're demented, can't tell right from wrong. So they're not really able to testify even in a deposition. But that's not a major aspect. The main area of civil matters, and remember, civil litigation The goal is to make the victim whole, assuming that their victimization is proven in court. It's to make them whole, and that's only done by money. So if your spouse was killed, you can't bring back the spouse, but the victim of that is given money. And so damages and causation are the two issues in most civil litigation. Are they damaged? Did what the defendant is alleged to have done actually damage them? Did it exacerbate some pre-existing psychological damage? Or are they now demonstrating the same psychological symptoms that they had before the issue came up that led to the litigation? And it's not but for the litigation they would have been symptomatic. They would have been symptomatic regardless, even if the litigation never happened. That's the damages question. And then the causation, well, that's the causation question. And then the damages has to do with, are they functionally impaired as a result of what the defendant is alleged to have done to them?
That's
complicated.
Yeah, it's very complicated. The next question is about mass torts and multi-plaintiff litigation. And I think that that'll help us with kind of unpacking a little bit further.
Sure.
With an example that we have. So what is mass torts or multi-plaintiff litigation?
Sure. This is a kind of litigation where a lot of people have the same basic facts of what happened to them. People worked, as an example, people worked in an oil refinery and there was an explosion. And some people who were very close to the explosion were physically damaged. Some people may have been killed.
Yeah.
Other people were physically damaged. Of the survivors, many, if not all of them, are claiming severe emotional distress, often post-traumatic stress disorder. They saw somebody killed. They thought they were going to die. They may have suffered some not life-threatening injuries. Whatever it is, they have an emotional damages claim. And there's a group of people, and it all has to do with the same incident. There are two ways to do this. They can file a, usually in mass tort cases, individual claims that then the court puts together because they all have to do with this one oil refinery explosion. So the court has to manage, and this can be five people, it can be 50 people, it can be 500 or 5,000 people, depending on the circumstance. This is not a class action. That's similar, but different. A class action is when thousands of people were ripped off by Wells Fargo Bank, having opened accounts for which they were charged in their name,
yeah,
and which they didn't request. They file a class action. There may not be any emotional damages claims. There may be just economic damages claims in that. They could have been distressed, but they probably weren't severely emotionally distressed, felt suicidal as a result of that, et cetera. And that's handled differently by the courts. And the first task there is, do these people have, in fact, a very close common experience? Where forensic psychiatrists come in class actions, as opposed to multi-plaintiff actions, for example, I was called, there was a cruise ship that sailed through a hurricane, and it was very rocky, and people were all sick on board. And they had, I don't know, 300 or 400 people claim post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of this. And they had a telephone questionnaire by some not very good, non-forensically trained psychiatrist who asked them questions about how upset they were, et cetera, et cetera. A class has to be certified by the court as a class before it can proceed. The key question in certifying it, there are others, but the key one is, How common or distinct are the plaintiffs in this group that you're saying all had the same experience? They had the same trauma. This case, because it was emotional damages they were claiming, not economic damages from being wrongly charged for opening bank accounts. It's very difficult to make the case that they are a class because everyone has their own resiliency factors and vulnerability factors, their own unique history, and what they brought to that sailing through a hurricane was distinct and unique rather than identical. That would be the spectrum.
Okay.
So that's a class action, but the mass torts, and we're really set up to do the mass torts because we're a team of 32 very well-trained experts, and we've done lots of mass torts. Mass torts are more like, I was saying, an example would be an industrial accident. There are other forms of mass torts. You know, it could be a family of five who live in a house where there's been mold found, and they're alleging not just health damages from the mold exposure, but great stress and concern. Or a better example, we were involved in a case where there were various defendants, including the state, because a dry cleaner was allowed to put solvent into the ground that contaminated the water supply in that area with potentially cancer-causing drugs, TCP. And so there was fear of cancer in that population. And that was an emotional damage that was being claimed. So, but those were individual claims because how I respond to that potential threat is different from how you respond. And so we're not identical as we are in the bank opening checking accounts case. When that happens, there are unique dynamics and unique logistical challenges. What are the logistical challenges? Well, let's say you have 50 people and whatever happened because this is the way litigation goes 3 years ago. And they now live all over the United States. How do you evaluate these people? There are issues of, are they available to be evaluated? Do you have licenses? Because medical licensing requires that the evaluator both be evaluated in the state where the person is located, and if it's being done remotely, also in the state where the evaluator is located. So there's a lot of, you know, paperwork and applications that have to be done.
Yeah.
And getting people together so that the evaluations can be done efficiently. So those are some of the logistic problems. There are others. The dynamic problems are intellectually interesting to me because I'm a geek in this. If you have like my oil refinery explosion case, you can draw a bell curve. You know, it's like a, looks like a mountain, a rounded mountain, to show the spread of damages. At one end, people are undamaged. At the other end, people are very severely damaged or killed.
Yeah.
And in the middle two-thirds, there's some damages. So if you have a population of people that you need to develop opinions about and opine about their damages, then this is called a bell curve or a normal curve or a Gaussian curve. You'd expect that to be the distribution of damages. But that's not how the court works. The court says, plaintiff's attorneys and defense attorneys, we're going to have a sample group because I can't try 50 lawsuits at once. We're going to do 10. In order to make them representative, so-called, you, the plaintiff's attorneys, are going to give me 5, and you, the defense attorneys, are going to give me 5. And what happens is the plaintiffs give you the worst 5, and the defense give you the undamaged 5, and you've got a barbell, not a bell curve. And
oh,
so the task is to infer from those extremes what the majority of people are actually like, who will be in the middle somewhere. I mean, that's why I say this is my kind of geeky interest, but this is a challenge of how do you do this? How can you say
right.
with accuracy? And one of the ways that comes out, and one of the ways that it's useful that we use a team approach, traditionally, law firms will create their own panel of experts. They'll hire psychiatrists, they'll hire psychologists, and they'll divide up the cases and they'll say, you know, you do these five and you do these five, et cetera. And these A are people who the attorneys may or may not know the skill level of their people, even though they've looked at their curriculum vitae. They may not even know whether they're board certified in forensic psychiatry, as surprising as that is, that's actually true. And these are people who've never worked together. So in contrast, and each person is doing, you know, a few cases, the plaintiff wants every one of their cases to be among the most severely damaged. That's the conclusion they would like. And the defense would like the cases to be undamaged. I'm exaggerating, but that's basically how it spreads. When we're a team, we can say to the court, let's say we're a defense team, Ms. Jones does not have post-traumatic stress disorder, and here's why. She has an adjustment disorder, and it's really minor, and it's easy to treat, and it's not worth $5 million to treat because there's no basis for that. It's not causing functional impairment in her life to any large degree. She still goes on vacation. She still teaches. She still does whatever.
I see.
Mm-hmm. But Mr. Jones did have PTSD because he was also in the war 10 years ago and was traumatized then and had PTSD, and it was reactivated by this. And he's locked up in his bedroom, no longer working, no longer interacting with people, et cetera. That gives us credibility because we've seen the whole population. And it's like, I don't know if you recall, there's an old classic Japanese film called Rashomon, where people tell a story like a wheel, and everyone's story is a spoke, and everyone's story is a little different, which is in fact reality. When we've interviewed a whole group of people from a single traumatic event, we get this collective view of what's happened. The formal way of saying it is that every plaintiff is a collateral informant for every other plaintiff. In other words, they too experienced this event. Well, and what they tell you has something to do with how you view the next person's, how accurate or inaccurate and exaggerated is the next person's report, because you get a really three-dimensional view of what actually happened. Those are the interesting dynamics of...
Yeah, that's what makes it probably really interesting to be in the field. Well, this last question that I have as we close out our conversation, when you were talking about mass torts or multi-plaintiff litigation, the first thing that kind of came to my mind as I was preparing was in 2016, Larry Nassar was charged with sexually assaulting 265, the number's more, but the number for this case was 265 young national and Olympian gymnastics who were subjected to his perverted, sexually invasive procedures under the guise of medical treatment. He's a convicted pedophile who will spend the rest of his life in jail. My question is, how do forensic psychiatrists assist the litigators who are trying or defending? And you were explaining this, you know, of all the dynamics of that before. But in this case, the sexual abuse part of this, Larry Nassar was the gymnastics team medical doctor.
Yes.
So how do you respond? Like, how would you organize that kind of a case? Because it's so hard to prove.
Yes. Okay. It's we've done a lot of sexual abuse cases because about, I don't know now, 6 or 7 years ago, up to 40 states passed a law that said people who were sexually abused as minors and could no longer sue because the statute of limitation in that state was 2 years or 3 years and it was long expired, would have a new window of, let's say, 3 years, it depends on the state, when they could, even if they're 70 years old and they were alleging to have been molested as a teenager, they can enter the law. This is how E. Jean Carroll was able to sue Donald Trump for sexual abuse that happened decades ago. So we've done a lot. There have been a flood of these cases, and we've done lots of these cases. The specific lawsuit you're talking about. First of all, there's a criminal case against him, which results in his being imprisoned for life, I think. That's the criminal case. Then what follows the criminal case are the civil litigations, the mass tort litigations from all the victims who are suing to be made whole, basically to be given money, because that's the only thing the civil litigation system in our country can provide for their damages. So these are very interesting and challenging cases, the old sexual abuse cases. And we've done them with coaches, with schools, with ministers and religious leaders, etc. What you have to do is first understand, get as good a picture as you can of what actually happened. For example, we examined a bunch of middle-aged women who were on teenage swim teams and were abused by the coach. Some were had actual intercourse. Others had inappropriate touching. Others had just very seductive behavior, telling them, if I were your, I would marry you, you're beautiful, you know, your body is great. And so there's this range of insult, meaning damage, in that population. So what you then have to learn in these cases invariably are alleging, amongst other things, post-traumatic stress disorder. You have to learn by looking at the entire life's course of this individual. To what extent were they functionally impaired by what happened? That's where the rubber meets the road of the balance between their vulnerability factors and their resiliency factors. We all have a mixture of both. You know, the balance is different for each of us.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if somebody had been sexually abused by a family member when they were 7 or 8, and then at 14 or 15, they're sexually abused by a coach, they're likely more vulnerable to damages than someone who had really a very supportive, solid early childhood experience with their parents and their family, and then had to deal with this event as a teenager. This is just a hypothetical. All things are not equal. I would expect, without knowing more, that the person who came from a solid early childhood foundation is more resilient to that. It's going to have less lasting damage on their functioning than the person who had a very difficult early childhood.
Oh, interesting.
So that becomes important. And that gets played out over the decades that follow. You know, they were never able to make a successful intimate relationship. They became a prostitute or a dancer in clubs. They became a drug addict. Things really didn't go well. And then the question, which is even more complicated, is parsing it. To what extent is that the result of 1 year of a sexual relationship with a coach at 16 or 17 versus the really difficult childhood from which they came? And to what extent would they have had those kinds of problems even if the seduction had never happened? And this is difficult to make, but you look at a lot of data to try and infer evidence-based opinions that are accurate. This is very much a case where the real, if you have a population of people, let's say, whom one swimming coach was sexually inappropriate with to varying degrees, depending on the individual, you'll have this bell curve distribution of damages. And some people will not really be damaged in the sense that they were not functionally impaired. They went on, they became married, parents, successful in their careers. Despite this, other people are basket cases. So, and again, that's where we, when we come in as a team, can say to the trier of fact, this person is damaged and this person really isn't. And here's why.
Yeah, that's wow. I hadn't thought about it, you know, from that perspective. Yeah. Yeah. Cause you know, when you weigh in, you know, how you grew up and how, you know, it's like pre-existing conditions medically, you have pre-existing conditions sexually.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And also that doesn't make, just to be clear about this, if an adult was sexually inappropriate with a minor, from touching to having a sexual intercourse relationship with them, none of that's appropriate. This doesn't say, oh, it's okay because they're resilient.
Right.
But unfortunately, our civil litigation system rewards the disabled, not the resilient, because damages requires functional impairment. And so it's not fair in that sense. You can say, you know, what he did was terrible. He's in prison because of it. A jury found him guilty of this. And yet, to make me whole doesn't take much money. Whereas somebody else, it may take years and years of treatment and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I think that, and then, you know, I wonder, well, what makes them whole? That's a really good question.
Yes,
it's kind of loaded in some elements too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
well, it's answering it. I mean, it doesn't make someone whole in a sense. It just compensates them. That's really, and it's not the same.
Yeah. And do you have any ideas of what we could do in addition to compensating people financially? But there's other ways to compensate people. A lot of times you hear of cases, you know, it's based on they want some form of acknowledgement, which in these severe cases never happens.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Let's take sexual abuse cases. It is empowering to litigate against the abuser and win and prosecute them as well. That's empowering for people who have felt entirely without power. This is an adult exploiting a minor who wanted their approval and was in a competitive team and wanted to succeed, and all these imbalances of power. So being able to finally be heard, because invariably victims of sexual abuse are plagued by feelings that it was their own fault. They may not know that other people on the team were sexually abused. That's not because nobody talks about it.
Right.
Usually.
Yeah.
So this is my burden that I carry all these years. So the ability to, in a public forum, even though it's very difficult, to be heard and to, I think E. Jean Carroll expressed this richly and how empowering it was for her to finally, after decades, confront Donald Trump and have the jury confirm that this is what happened, validate her experience. So that is, you know, a sense, a form of justice which may come out of it. Often, sadly, though, making someone really whole means healing their emotional scars as best as possible, which means good treatment. And frequently, what you get is a good verdict with a lot of money and no treatment follows, even though the argument by the plaintiff's side is it's going to take 10 years of, you know, twice a week psychotherapy and blah, blah, blah. And it doesn't happen because it doesn't happen. They're not really motivated. And nobody, there's no supervisor of the court saying, and now that you've won this case, you've got to spend X dollars on getting the treatment you need. Nobody does that.
Yeah, right. Well, it's good to learn more about our legal system. And I like the pathology part of it, the forensic piece of it. Every business owner, so if we're talking about business owners, small business owners that I work with, every business owner I've ever worked with, there's always been a lawsuit that's involved in the work that they do. It just is inevitable. And so the more that we can understand how the law works, so understanding the different aspects of how things are litigated and what is weighed and how complicated our legal system is, I think it makes you appreciate what goes into each case that's presented, I guess.
Okay.
All right. In regard to small business owners and employment law, tell us what your thoughts are just, you know, as we close out regarding employment law.
Yes. A big section of forensic psychiatric consulting involves employment law because people sue their employer for wrongful termination, for discrimination on the basis of age, ethnicity, gender, race, and also for retaliation and failure to accommodate. Those are the areas in which employees sue their employers. From a defense perspective, what happens a lot is people are fired for cause and then retrospectively say, but I'm a minority. You are obviously discriminating against me because I can find some white person who was promoted and I was fired. This is totally hypothetical, but this comes up over and over again. Or it was age, or it was gender, or it was, you know, the color of my hair, you know, if you're a flight attendant. So the issue becomes, to what extent does the existing extensive law, like on discrimination, apply legitimately to this employee's experience? And to what extent is it a convenient focus to cover up the fact that they had been put on warning at several different points that their performance was not up to expectation and they really weren't meeting that? Here's an example. Somebody is an older person and works for a large company in a process, let's say logistics, that requires increasingly the ability to use modern technology, because logistics at one point was keeping track on a pad of paper of where materials are and when they're supposed to be delivered. Skip ahead 20 years and logistics use all kinds of complicated computer algorithms to not only say, you know, if you think of Amazon, was this box delivered on Tuesday? But how many of these boxes are ordered and where do they get distributed to? And what are the intermediary distribution steps and on and on and on?
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that a person who's in their late 60s, who's been doing this job starting when they did it on a manual spreadsheet with a piece of paper, is not up to doing this job as it's been redefined in 2024. So they're let go. Not even complicated, you know, they're offered a different job or whatever. They're just let go after discussing this, not just abruptly without any notice. And they say, this is obvious age discrimination because, look, you hired a 32-year-old who took over this job. It's actually a different job the 32-year-old took over because they were able to do all the computer algorithm stuff that the 67-year-old couldn't do. But that's the nuanced reality where this gets fought. I know, were they discriminated against for age and illegally so, or were they fired for cause because the company is not obligated to modify the job description to the point that it's no longer the same job? Add to that, after they're fired, oh, but I have ADHD and you didn't accommodate me. And then the question becomes, well, did you request accommodation for ADHD? Well, I did, but it was like 2 weeks before you fired me, even though you've been for a year and a half telling me I'm not performing well. These, again, the nuances of, because if you are disabled, there's a whole, you know, the Americans Disability Act, and states have their own versions of this, have obligations for employers that they have to try to accommodate. But they don't have to accommodate if they can't do the basic tasks of the job. They can make it easier for them, but they can't. They don't have to change the job in order. That's that degree of accommodation is not like if you have to be a dispatcher in a warehouse and you say, but I've got agoraphobia, I can only work from home. That's a different job, you know, and right. That kind of accommodation is not reasonable.
Yeah. So reasonability is also part of the equation.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but in all these cases, what's claimed is severe emotional distress. There's two legal terms of art: negligent infliction of emotional distress, NIED, and IIED, intentional infliction of emotional distress. And these are the terms of art that plaintiff's employment lawyers allege was done. And then they'll go and say the person, as a result of the intentional infliction of emotional distress, they have depression, they have anxiety, they can't sleep, and so on and so forth. And those are the damages. And then there are economic damages. They've been unemployed for a year and a half. But sometimes, I'm in a case now where somebody applied for a new job while they're on the job from which they were fired and started working immediately. They have no economic damages, but they're alleging that they were discriminated against, or failed to be accommodated, and were retaliated for requesting accommodation. So that's the battleground where it happens. And we have a lot to say about what are the damages. And, you know, for example, if this person who says, you retaliated against me for saying 2 weeks before I was fired that I had ADD, and I'm a ethnic minority, and other people were promoted to a job to which this person may not have even been qualified, but there were promotions of other people and not me. And I've got intentional infliction of emotional distress. And then we give them a series of robust psychological tests. What the tests show is that they answer questions like people who exaggerate and embellish their symptoms. And there's a database of hundreds of thousands or millions of people in that database. It's a very highly accurate conclusion.
Oh.
That becomes a factor in assessing their claims, their allegations, because they're prone to exaggerate and embellish. So their subjective narrative, this goes back to the difference between a treating doctor and an independent expert, their subjective narrative is a highly colored and exaggerated rendition of what their experiences were.
Excellent. Yeah. And I think with business owners, you know, making sure that you understand negligence and your intentions.
Yes.
If people aren't doing their work, you know, and the job isn't working out for someone, to take a look at, you know, what part are you playing in there, and what your intentions are in letting that person go. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for all that you've added to this conversation. You've been in the business for decades, and you've learned a lot, and you have so much to share. And I just appreciate you taking the time to share it.
Well, thank you. I really enjoy the opportunity to chat with you. So thanks a lot, Nancy.
Great. And thanks for tuning in. And please feel free to email questions that you have at nancy@wementor.com, and we can do some follow-up conversations, especially if you've got more questions about employment law. Very good. All right. Well,
that's
stay
excellent.
Tuned. We'll see you in the next time. Okay. Bye. all right. Excellent.
Do you want to expand your leadership skills and become more resilient and competent as a business owner? Do you want to bring more meaning to your relationships and more purpose to your business? Are you ready to take charge of how you innovate, create, and run your business? Our dual innovation leadership process will help you redefine how you lead as you redesign your business. We collaborate with you to do what will work for you as you evolve and change. We start with where you are, whether you are turning around a financial crisis, growing to the next level, or somewhere in between. We address your immediate needs, shore up business development gaps, expand relational literacy, and build upon your entrepreneurial leadership skill sets with a short-term results orientation and a long-term perspective. Start by subscribing to this podcast at wementor.com or anywhere you listen to your podcasts. If you are ready to hire a mentor, contact me at nancy@wementor.com. When we mentor, you create better life and a more fulfilling future, as an entrepreneurial leader slash innovator, as a competent business owner slash practitioner, as a mentor slash role model, and as a human being courageously living a meaningful life. As Gandhi said, be the change you wish to see in the world. Get involved today. It's never too late to change your life and how you lead.